Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Diane Mayer is a US-based embroidery artist whose cross-stitched photography obfuscates the present and offers a window into the past. This is the second part of our needle exchange, and in this episode we talk about Diane's work. She has an exhibition that's taking place in Berlin, which is almost a magnum opus, 50 of her pieces, 50 photographs of Berlin that she's stitched on, and we talk about Berlin, what it means to her, what it's like to go back and recreate some of your earlier works again, and just how she's able to explore histories and places through her art. As this is the second part of our exchange, we find out her favourite books, music, and the kind of films she likes to watch. And we discover a talent that you wouldn't expect that turns out to have been put to great use back in the day in her fact that not a lot of people know. It's been great to talk to Diane. I've been such a fan of her work for such a long period of time. I've had the pleasure of exhibiting it, and so it was great to finally talk around the houses with her and get to know her. So I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. Diane's work is amazing. You can find out all her details in the show notes, of course. And I hope you're enjoying the show. Please do feel free to get in touch. hello@needle.exchange with like four E's. I've talked about that previously. And let me know if there are any particular artists you think I should be in touch with. I've got a nice few people lined up in the future to be talking with, but I'm always open to more ideas. And it'd be great to get some feedback as well. But I hope you enjoy the show. I hope you enjoy this part of the conversation with Diane. And I will be back next week with another needle exchange with another artist. So for now, enjoy the show. So tell me about the show in Berlin then. That's all of the pieces.
And I'm doing, so I went back and re-photographed in February, so I'm adding seven new pieces, because I had 43, so I'm just adding seven more to make it an even 50, and it's, the show's in conjunction with the 35th anniversary of the fall of the wall.
Wow. Okay. Wow. So you've got quite an affection for Berlin then.
Yeah, I think, I think it was just really fascinating to me. I remember watching the wall fall on TV when I was 13, But then when I got there, I realized how little I actually knew about it. And I think that's partially, besides thinking about it in terms of memory or thinking of it as a ghost in the landscape, I think, you know, I was also struck by what I thought I knew and how what I thought I knew was wrong. And I didn't realize how big it was. And I didn't realize how much of it extended into the suburbs and into the forests and around the lakes. So really only about like maybe 10 or 15% of it is in the city center. And the rest of it is way out in the suburbs and forests and would really separate you from nature. And I guess most importantly, I didn't realize that it was a ring. I thought it just kind of happened to divide Berlin, in that, but I didn't realize that it completely surrounded the West like that. And
it's
so,
a bit bonkers, isn't it? Because they split the country, but like you say, then within one half of the country, they split an entire city as well.
So it was almost like a hole in like a Swiss cheese of East Germany, West Berlin. So that was really fascinating to me too. And I just felt like, again, even though it was cold, I really love exploring and just walking around cities and discovering things. And there's so much to explore there. So it became a really interesting place.
I mean, did you find out that you learned quite a lot about East Germany as a consequence of just doing this project? Have you had to kind of gin up on it?
I mean, maybe not so much the project, but maybe just being there. Where the residency was in the eastern part. So that was interesting to me, like, especially sometimes if you went into a store or something, like older people couldn't speak English, whereas in other parts of the city, everyone was bilingual or bilingual in terms of speaking English and German, but it would like sometimes be more common for people to be speaking German and Russian in the East instead of German and English. And, you know, just some of like the bakery, there are these sort of like older, like traditional bakeries that were really different. And
are there any other places in the world that provoke a similar interest? I know you've talked about Venice as well, but I just, you know, it's kind of making me think about like kind of Northern Ireland and stuff like that. I wonder if there are any other places that you're like, I can feel a project coming on about that place.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm not sure. I haven't spent, I guess, probably maybe Florence, just because I used to teach in a summer study abroad program in Florence. So I've spent a lot of time there over the years. And so I feel like I've been able to really explore it. I feel like other cities, I just haven't maybe spent enough time there to really like
get under the
skin to kind of lead to a project. Like I've been there maybe as a tourist for a couple of days or, you know, maybe a week at the most or something. So it hasn't really been enough time to really explore in an in-depth way.
Mm. Yeah. I went to Florence, Mary, and I went there only for like 6 days, I think, or something. But we were like, and we went on a food tour that was called Florence for Foodies, where an English lady who obviously lived there took us to like the market, and we tried various bits and pieces from there. And there was a little gelato place that we found that was on like, it was across the river and it was on a square, and it sold like pistachio gelato just out of a little shack or something. And we were sitting there, and across the way in the park, there were like some children from the school doing like gymnastics exercises or something. And you just really felt like you just got underneath it, you know, you got away from the tourists. You just got to sit there and like watch real Florentian life or whatever. Such a nice place. Do you come to England much?
I've come to England a few times. I mean, especially when I was doing study abroad, I would usually like have my layover in London and have the layover be like a few days. So I've been there a bunch of times, but really only for like a couple of days each time. And I haven't, unfortunately, I'd really like to, but I haven't gone outside of London to explore the rest of England.
It's not much right home about the rest of the place. No. That's good. And then, so then Los Angeles, is that a muse for you, or is that just a place where you're kind of living? Because as you said, there's not a lot of, I don't know. I don't want to sound like I'm slagging Los Angeles off, but it doesn't seem to have the depth of character of some of the other places that we're talking about, shall we say.
Yeah, I've done a few projects about LA. None that involved embroidery, but I did a project like kind of thinking about kind of the lost history of the city, where I made a you know, those like souvenir penny machines where mm-hmm.
yeah, you can press it. We got one from the science yeah. museum the other day. Yeah.
So there's some really kind of old historic neighborhoods that had all these Victorian houses and were really a place called Bunker Hill that ended up getting flattened and raised and turned into like skyscrapers. It's in downtown LA, and these like really beautiful historical buildings that were just kind of destroyed in the 60s and as part of like an urban renewal project. And so I made a customized elongated penny machine of Bunker Hill and then put it in the current location. So it was sort of about like the lost history of place. And I did a project about celebrity culture that was a photo-based project. And it was sort of a series of self-portraits of myself with different celebrity impersonators. And then I did the project just about carlessness in LA.
Did you find 100 people? I mean, I guess there's a lot, isn't it? What is it?
That was the biggest joke that I would hear when, when I would tell people about this project. They would say, "Are you sure there are 100 people?"
I like the nonchalant way as well. You just went, "I just made an elongated penny machine." I mean, did you take like an old one and just convert it, or did you build one from scratch?
Yeah, it was like I didn't build the penny machine. I made drawings. And then sent the drawings to like a penny machine place.
Is that still a thing then? Are they still like, you could go and buy yourself an elongated yeah. penny machine if you really wanted?
Yeah, you can. and then I just submitted drawings and had the plates made for it, basically.
And are you know, like, so here's a dumb question. This is a good dumb question, actually. In the same way as professors of history have to periodically write history theses in order to perpetuate their own academia, are you required to do the same thing, but in a photography context then?
No. So that's, I guess, the nice thing about having an MFA. You don't have to do a written thesis. Right.
Okay.
It's just the visual work. I mean, you have to write a catalog, but
you still have to do like your own exploratory process, right? And is that what these projects were then?
No. The project I worked on in graduate school was about, I grew up on the East Coast and had gone to college on the East Coast, and so when I moved to San Diego for grad school, it was kind of my first time experiencing the West. And so I did a project that kind of incorporated a lot of smaller projects that was about kind of the West as the mythology of the American West and the West as invented space and the contrast of this kind of like Western mythology with the actual location of it. And so it had, there were a few photo projects. There were some like modified thrift store paintings. There was like a sort of interactive like 16 millimeter film. And then I made a like a life-size cabin made out of Lincoln logs, which I guess like maybe is where I became able to withstand hours of sewing on end.
So
because
on.
It was
like, you made a log cabin. Is that like literally you made a log cabin?
Yeah. No, I mean that it wasn't so big that you could live in it, but it was, you know, size of like a van maybe or something.
That's
still... you could go inside of it, but
so that made you hardy, like, is what you're saying as well then.
It made me able to withstand repetitive monotonous tasks.
For all those lumberjacks out there who are considering a career move, you'll be fit enough to be an embroiderer at any point whatsoever. There's a definite theme, isn't there, with all of these projects. There is this theme of like just looking back in time and just querying, I guess, why we're at where we're at right now.
Yeah, I think so. I've always kind of been interested in history and you know, and place and how places change over time.
Mm. And I guess, yeah, it sounds like I'll just go, and so what have you got coming up next or whatever? But it seems like really you're just still exploring these existing projects, isn't it? Like the Berlin project persists and continues. Does it feel like you're, like, do you think 50 you'll be like, yeah, 50, I'm done? Or do you think at a certain point you'll be like, oh, 51 just popped into the back of my head?
Yeah, I think it's done. I feel like I have to end it somewhere. And I've always wanted to show the work in Berlin, and I haven't really.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Yes, aside from like a fair that was just like for a weekend during the pandemic that, you know, I don't think many people want to because it peak COVID. Yeah. But so I guess I kind of see like this show as being like the end of it. But then also when I went in February, it was interesting to, because it just changed so much from the time when I first photographed it. So places that had been empty lots were huge condos and big buildings, and it just changed so much that when I walked around the wall, I would think like, I've never been here before, like, but I thought I like did the entire circumference. How could I never have been here before? And then I realized that I had been. It's just like it looked completely different. And so then it, you know, it seems like a project that could go on forever because the city changes so much. And I don't know who said it. I think it was like some architectural historian or something, but someone once said that something about like Berlin is destined to be a city that is always becoming but never to be or something, because it's always like in flux and changing so much. But and it really felt that way this last time that I went, because everything was so different from the last time I had been there.
Yeah. That's interesting. It's just made me think there's a new Tom Hanks film coming out called Here, Tom Hanks and Robin Wright. And basically, the camera stays put. So it starts in the prehistoric era, and the camera stays put, and everything that happens is from that one camera shot. But obviously, it spins through time. So by the look of it, at a certain point, you see a house being built, and then everything you see is within the room of that house that's being built. And it's like Tom Hanks and his wife over time getting older. Seems as though they end up there as like really old people going, you know, this is the house that we lived in for the whole of our lives or whatever. But it's almost to that point that you're saying, the whole conceit is just the camera never moves. So it does start out with like, I don't know, a volcano exploding somewhere down the line. I guess a reptile climbs out of a pond of water or whatever. Uh-huh. Kind of like that same thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. I haven't heard of the movie yet. But
no, well, when you finish like, stitching for 150,000 hours, you'll be able to like get it on VHS or something. Or something. Yeah, interesting. Right, I'm going to ask you some good questions. Do you have a favorite band / album?
Yeah, I was thinking of this because I knew that I thought this question would be coming, but it's funny when you say album, because I listen, because music is streaming, mm-hmm. and you never are kind of listening to it anymore in the order that the band intended, mm-hmm. which is kind of strange because it doesn't have, I mean, I feel like albums are almost like books in a way that they like have like
a flow in it,
but I never really listen to albums anymore because I'm always listening to just streaming music that's mm-hmm. on shuffle or something. But I would say, so it's hard for me to pick an album because I feel like
it's fine.
I just no longer listen to albums that much anymore. But I would say, like, I really like Patti Smith and Iggy Pop, the David Bowie.
Mm-hmm. So you listen to music when you're working, I'm guessing?
Sometimes. I've been listening to a lot of podcasts recently, including yours.
Thank you very much. Thanks very much.
Appreciate books. I mean, sometimes I watch movies or TV shows or something when I'm sewing, or, you know, kind of like listen to them at least.
Do you find that because, I guess with your work, because it's quite technical, I'd imagine that when it comes to actually doing the stitching, you've done all the prep work. So really you're just executing your own plan, aren't you? You don't have to do a lot of imagining next steps. So in some ways you can allow yourself to, like you say, like watch a film. It's not going to influence, or if you're listening to a different type of music, it's not going to influence the direction of the thing you're making particularly.
Yeah, because I mean, it's kind of just like the mindless like action of doing it, because all of the more conceptual part has already been determined. So it's just like having to just physically do it.
Mm. Yeah. I'm quite a fan, just to what you were saying about streaming. I quite like buying compilation albums these days, to be honest. Just because in a way it's kind of the same, like we've got a caravan and the caravan's got a CD player in it, and sometimes that's quite useful, but now particularly certain compilation CDs are cheap as chips, so I keep buying them. You can tell we're going on holiday soon because like three or four NAF compilation albums will drop through the door and my wife will moan at me about buying them, but I do quite like it because somewhere within that, in the same way as streaming, I suppose, but algorithmically I think streaming tunes into what you like, don't you? Whereas when you buy a compilation album, sometimes you're stabbing around in the dark and there's some really dreadful songs you kind of have to wade your way through. But I kind of like there's a sort of analog, it's like an analog appeal of the streaming thing, because you're just like, and then there'll be a song. I've got this one called Now That's What I Call Jazz, which is a compilation of jazz tunes. And a lot of the stuff it plays is like the sort of stuff you would expect to hear if it was like, I don't know, someone DJing. But there's one particular song in it, and I should really remember the name, but it's just absolutely beautiful. And it's like song number 20 on CD number 2. And when I play it in the caravan, I'm just sitting there, and just the rise and fall of the way the lady's singing, and it's kind of like 1960s vibe or something. And you're like, that was worth my £3 just for that one song, you know, just in the middle of all of that.
So are they compilations by genre, or do you mean like greatest hits of a particular band?
I think they're usually by genre, because we had this series over here called Now That's What I Call Music, and it started around the time that I was a kid. So my favourite for a very long time was Now That's What I Call Music number 5, which had bands like Duran Duran on it. And you know, would have been like really early Madonna, kind of like late 1980s. But from that point onwards, they're on to like Now That's What I Call Music, about 120 now or something. But then they've also broken it into subgenres as well. So I recently bought Now That's What I Call 1980s Party, which has got Ghostbusters on it, has got all the classic like Taylor Dane, Tiffany and all of those kind of songs in a row. So there's a lot of that as well. And then I choose my genres kind of carefully. And because it's a caravan and because we're being like old school, I'm kind of like, Now That's What I Call Easy Listening, which, you know, I used to be a badass. I like to pretend I used to be a badass, and I did used to be into heavy metal and stuff like that. Whereas now I'm just like a bit of Cat Stevens in the caravan will go down very nicely. Thanks very much.
Yeah, I can relate.
There's an app called BBC Sounds, which the BBC produce, and on BBC Six Music, which is a radio station we've got over here, Iggy Pop's got his own radio show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which You probably would like, because a lot of the time he's got a super gravelly voice as well. So he's mostly just like, and then plays like some old post-punk song from like 1982 or something or other. But that feels like that. Yeah. Worth a look out. Yeah, do. Right. So favorite film? Favorite TV show? That territory?
Well, I would say my favorite TV show is probably... there's two, probably. One would be The Sopranos, which I know one of your other guests was talking about recently, too. But I grew up in New Jersey, so I think it also has a familiarity.
It's like a documentary.
Yeah, and I like The Americans, which was a show. It's about this typical suburban family that... in the suburbs, but they're really like KGB agents.
Yeah,
like
sleeper agents, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. My favorite film is The Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Okay.
Which is a film from the 60s. It's a French film from the 60s, but I love it because it's just so incredible in terms of the use of color and just visually. We were talking about wallpaper before, and there's all of this like really heavily patterned wallpaper and complementary colors and ways that color is used very symbolically with the characters and what's happening. And it's all, every word is sung. So it almost is kind of like an opera, but it's just like, and it's, you know, kind of, you know, just this, I mean, it's not so much about the plot, but it's just like such a like stunning movie visually. And I just love looking at it.
Do you, in your own personal photography preference, do you prefer color or are you quite at ease with black and white as well? Do you have a preference?
Yeah, I would say color. I mean, I have done a bunch of black and white photography, but I think... color and the way that you can use color and play colors off of one another, it just is something that is really appealing to me.
It just got me thinking about like how I think somehow I've got a little internal prejudice against black and white movies, and the reason I was thinking that was because when you said about that film, it kind of reminded me of the film Roma. Have you seen that? And that's beautiful, isn't it? It's beautiful, but it's completely black and white. And I was like, actually, it does a great job by being black and white. It doesn't need the color to be part of the storytelling process in that instance. And then it just got me thinking whether I should be a bit more broad-minded in my black and white film.
Yeah, I love the movie Night of the Hunter, which is a black and white film that is really visually kind of expressionistic and uses shadow. I mean, that's like such a beautiful movie visually, and that's black and white. And The Umbrellas of Cherbourg kind of reminds me a bit of like Wes Anderson in a way, and in the way that it's so kind of stylized and uses color.
Yeah, it sounds like it could be. Yeah, I've written that down. That sounds like a good one to look out for. The other thing I was thinking, because with black and white films as well, and particularly with a time, they had so much less to use that it was about the cinematography and the acting. And then I heard a thing the other day, like The Maltese Falcon with Humphrey Bogart in it. Apparently within about a 4-year period or something, or maybe a 10-year period, they made 3 versions of that. The same studio, really? Because they tried it just with different combinations of actors and it had certain feelings, and then they went no, and then they just tried it again, and in a way that they would never do now, but they kind of like made the film third time they made the film Humphrey Bogart, and everyone went, oh well, there you go, that was the right combination after all. I just thought it was really interesting because again, they couldn't go, oh well, we'll just chuck in a dinosaur with a bit of CGI or whatever. They would just like really had to kind of grind out or whatever. I like that. I'll write that down. Favorite book?
I don't know, like, if I could say favorite, but something like some things I've read recently that I've liked a lot. I think because I was working on or thinking about the Venice Project, there's a book called Watermark by a poet named Joseph Brodsky, but he would go to Venice every January for, I mean, at least a decade or more. And it's sort of this memoir about Venice and the winter time, but it's just really beautifully written. And then because I have so much sewing to do this summer, I found this app called Libby, which I don't know if have it in the UK, but it connects to your library and you can listen to audiobooks. So I decided that I would go through, I found some list somewhere of 100 greatest novels of all time. And I was like, I'll just, as I'm have 10,000 hours of sewing to do this summer, I'll just go through. And the first one was Anna Karenina, which is so long, but it's a 50-hour audiobook. So my plan of going through this Sharks, I kind of rotate throughout the day between podcasts and TV and music and audiobook. But I've been wanting to go through this list, and I'm still on number one because number one has been such a long time.
Can you order the list by length of time and then just go one long one, five short ones, kind of pick your way through or something? I love that. And end with War and Peace to really drive your way through to the finish line or something.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But it is it's a pretty amazing book just in terms of Tolstoy just getting into all of the character. I mean, it's very relatable in terms of human emotion and why people do things. So it's a pretty amazing book. I had never read any of his books before, but just kind of chose it.
I think that's a brilliant idea, to be honest. Because you wouldn't, I think sometimes with a lot of these books, you wouldn't think, I'm just going to sit down and read them, but you've got to sit down and do something. So you may as well find out why these books are so acclaimed. It's genius. You have to check back and let me know if there are any really good ones, possibly within about a 3-hour length or something.
Yeah. Yeah, if I ever been.
Have you ever read 100 Years of Solitude?
I haven't, no.
No. I'm chewing my way through that at the moment.
Oh, really? Do you like it? Is it good?
Yeah, it is. It is. It's for 400 pages, and they're quite dense pages. And so I usually read about 8 pages a night before I fall asleep or something like that. I think that would be a really good one on audio. I don't know if it's on the list.
Yeah.
But it's kind of it's quite dramatic and yet really funny. And then every now and again, he'll just put these ridiculously long sentences in. There was one that literally half the page was just one sentence, and it was all made perfect sense. But every now and again, they're just little pattern interrupts when those things happen, just to keep you on your toes. And then somebody will be 100 years old, and then the next day they'll die, and he'll just wave it on and just carry on. Or I don't know. It's just, yeah, it keeps you going. I can't read it intently. Because I read a lot of graphic novels as well, so I kind of work my way between the two. But I think that one, if it's on the list, I'd say you'll enjoy that one. It's good luck.
Yeah, it's one of those books that I know about and I've wanted, but I feel like I never get to read.
Depending on the narrator, I reckon that one would be a really enjoyable one. I'm almost tempted to go and listen to it myself. So final question, is there an interesting fact that not a lot of people know about Diane Mayer?
I don't know how interesting it is, but
I'll be the judge of that.
I no longer can use this skill because of cell phones and caller ID, but I can say anything in a very deadpan way and say almost anything without laughing. And so I used to be really, really masterful at prank calls, but
really?
I don't get to, which is not that interesting, but maybe so.
Go on. Give me a retelling of one of your best.
Let's see. They were a long time ago, but, so I guess, so a lot of times because I had this skill, people would come to me when they wanted me to pick someone that they knew. So when I was in college, one of my friends had gotten dumped by this girl, but in this like very kind of cruel way. And so he was like very upset. And so he knew the you know, the layout of her dorm room and where the furniture was and things like that. And so I called and said that I had gotten her number from the university or something, which I don't know why she believed that the university would have given it to me, but I sounded very frantic. And I said that I locked my brother in a safe and the combination I had lived in her dorm room the year before, and I had written the combination in pencil on the wall. And so basically, and my friend was like telling me where all the furniture was. So she basically had to like move all of this furniture to get to where this combination supposedly was. And then it wasn't there. And I was like, oh no, wait, I actually was on the other. So then she was all of the furniture on the other wall. And
that's when did you discover that you had this gift for not laughing?
I don't know. I think in high school, I maybe took a public speaking class, and the prompts were like pretty, I don't know, just to like entertain myself. I think I started just like creating these like kind of crazy stories that like ultimately kind of just to make people laugh. I used to really like, even though I'm like, I think I'm, well, kind of a bit shy, like I always kind of like trying to make people laugh, and so I think that was maybe one of the places where I started realizing that I could just say these kind of like crazy things and do it in this very deadpan way.
Are you like the comedian Stephen Wright? Is it a bit like that? You just like,
oh, I don't know him.
He's the guy, do you know Reservoir Dogs, and there's the radio station and he does the voiceovers for that. He's that guy who's just like, he just talks like this all the time, and his whole comedian thing, like he'll tell you the funniest one-liner but won't ever break monotone. Same sort of thing.
Oh, you know? Well.
Tell you stuff that would really make you laugh and then just be like, what was the, oh yeah, like so. So the other day I went to the library and I asked them if they had a book by Shakespeare, and they said, which one? And I said, William. But like that, you know, like deadpan. Because the good thing is you didn't laugh at that. So now I don't know whether you found it funny or
it's a bad joke.
No, but that must have been, did it for a long time. Did people just think that you didn't find them funny at all? Or would you like laugh genuinely and then just flick a switch in your head and just go deadpan all the time?
Oh yeah. I mean, like I definitely would laugh at things. I mean, I could say things without laughing at myself.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a nice skill to have. I sometimes see, is it Will Ferrell as well? Like seeing Will Ferrell go on things where people are trying to make him laugh and he'll just choose not to, because I think intrinsically he knows he's like the funniest person in the room. So he doesn't have to even, like, you can't make him laugh because he's just like trained. That's a good skill. I like that. And that's also very mean. Did that girl ever find out that it was a prank?
Probably in retrospect, like, because there were some implausible,
I think locking your brother in a safe or whatever, that's quite a good.
But I mean, I was like very frantic, so she might have been caught up in my emotion about my brother being a safe. But, you know, I'm sure like maybe a few hours later, as she was moving the furniture back, she might have like thought about how, like, why would the university at 9 o'clock at night be open? Someone my phone number.
You know? And would you co-author the pranks as well? Were you like did you come up with the pranks, or did you just execute what someone had given you?
I think I would come up with them and I would work with I would ask questions like, where is the prank? You know.
So actually you're an evil comedy genius. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not evil.
Yeah, he's just fighting injustice through the.
Yeah, like fighting injustice, exactly.
That's very good. If I ever think of anything really funny that needs to be read very seriously, then at least we know who to turn to now.
Yeah, but it's like a completely useless skill now because now everyone has caller ID.
Well, there is that, but you know, I think it's just we just got to put it in a different framework. I reckon there's something there. There's got to be somehow. But hey, Diane, thanks for having a needle exchange with me.
Oh, thank you so much. This was so fun, and it was so nice to talk to you. I mean, I've followed what you've been doing for so long, and I love the podcast, and it's really an honor to be part of it. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments, or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.